The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 21.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hello everyone to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. And this one, it's going to be just me again. You know, part of my vision when I asked you guys for some contributions was that I think if I just am upset about something, I'm just going to go off, record a podcast episode. And you guys have been contributing. For those who haven't, you should go to bobmurphyshow.com/contribute and get with the program. And so I thought probably you called my bluff. Let's follow through. So what I want to talk about, as the title suggests, is this disturbing trend on social media. I mean, it's broader than that, but we all see it quite clearly on social media, where I tried to do a funny play on words where I say the God of social media demands sacrifice, not mercy. So, of course, I'm playing off of something that came up in my discussion with David Gornowski. So that was bobmurphyshow.com/15, episode 15 of this podcast, where he made that a central point of his whole worldview. And that was a central point of our discussion, was to say that Jesus reminded his own listeners that God, and here Jesus was referring to the Old Testament, desires mercy, not sacrifice. Okay, so this is the flip side. And David, as we got in that discussion, episode 15 of the Bob Murphy Show, of course, thinks that that has a lot of relevance to current libertarians, even if they're not particularly religious, to say you need to understand the state is a vehicle that helps cater to the underlying human desire to others, like, you know, to punish. And you can see the relevance to this episode. So just for the context there, I don't think David and I fully got into it, but just to give you the backdrop there, and it's relevant too. I'm not just giving you this just as an aside. This actually is helping to set the stage for what I'm going to talk about in this episode. So this is from Matthew chapter 9, the ESV translation, starting at verse 9. As Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth. So he's a tax collector. And he said to him, "Follow me." And he rose and followed him. And as Jesus reclined at table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" But when he heard it, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick, go and learn what this means." Quote, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice," end quote. "For I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." Okay, so there, again, the Pharisees, the experts of the law, the Mosaic law, see Jesus hanging out with, I love that phrase, it says, with tax collectors and sinners, right? So it's kind of saying, yeah, sinners, you know, and of course, everybody's a sinner, but it's saying like those that the community knew, oh, those are the bad people, right? So Jesus is like hanging out with prostitutes and drunks and tax collectors. Like that's how those people were viewed in their society. So I think that's great. And the Pharisees, you know, the real self-righteous, pure people who think they're upholding the law when of course they're not, they're hypocrites, but the ones who lecture everybody else and wag their fingers, everyone's then challenge Jesus saying, or actually say to his disciples, because actually they're cowards, "Why does your teacher eat with the tax collectors and sinners?" I mean, he shouldn't be rubbing shoulders with these people. They're social pariahs. They're bad. Everybody knows that. And so then in that context, Jesus is answering them saying, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick, go and learn what this means." And now here he's quoting God speaking from what we call the Old Testament, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice." All right. So again, what Jesus is saying there is that, you know, you hypocrites, you teachers of the law, you should know this, that in your own law that you're supposed to be the experts of, God is saying, what I really want from you is to your heart to be changed. It's not that I need you to go slaughter animals and burn them to me because what do I need that or something? No, it's I want you to change your hearts. I want you to be merciful to each other, to the people who have wronged you or committed some slight, just like I, God, am merciful towards you. All right, so that's where the phrase, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, comes from. And so now you know why I'm calling this episode The God. Of course, it would be with a small g, except that it's a title. And that's why it's capitalized. But if I were writing it in a normal sentence, it would be a small g. The God of social media demands sacrifice, not mercy. Right, so that does not happen in social media, where we have these witch hunts, public executions, in quotation marks, if you will, where, you know, somebody does something wrong and then the whole mob comes up and strings them up, burns them at the stake, whatever metaphor you want to use. And in particular, though, here, what I want to focus on is just a particular element of what happens in this, in the people who are really culpable when it comes to this sort of thing and ought to know better. And this is the following, this principle I'm trying to get across here. If you are trying to whip up outrage against somebody and you're telling people, hey, you know what this person over here believes or said or did, and you know that what you are saying is either a flat out lie or you're saying something that's technically true, but you know is extremely misleading, and that any normal person hearing what you say is going to think the person you're targeting is a worse person than you know he really is, you should stop doing that. All right. There's no excuse for that. Not only is it intrinsically wrong, it has bad consequences. And I'll try to get to those at the end of this, but let me just give you folks some examples of the kind of thing I mean. So what actually prompted me to do this episode was I was reading this really interesting post. Obviously, I'll link to it at the show notes page. So right now you're listening to episode 21. So go to bobmurphyshow.com/21. So this was on February 22nd, 2019 by Scott Alexander. By the way, Scott Alexander is a pseudonym. That's not his real name. And the title of this is called RIP Culture War Thread, right? So Scott is saying rest in peace. They're putting to bed or burying this subreddit of Slate Star Codex that was called the Culture War. And let me just read the first two paragraphs and then I'll jump down to where it gets really interesting. But you need to hear this beginning part to understand the context. Several years ago, an SSC, so that stands for Slate Star Codex, this guy's blog, Slate Star Codex, he's a psychiatrist. And he's extremely interesting, and it's not worth getting into here for our purposes, except to say the guy is extremely fair-minded. All right, he's not a libertarian, but he's the kind of guy where he has a few big posts criticizing libertarianism, and that's on my wish list, or my to-do list, I should say, of I want to come back and rebut that, because this guy, Scott Alexander, is extremely open-minded. I'm not saying I'm going to change his mind, but at least he'll, if he sees my response, would say, oh, okay, yeah, I never thought of it like that. I see where this guy's coming from. All right, and this guy, I mean, I'm pretty sure he hates Trump's guts, for example, but he had an awesome post one time saying, you're still crying wolf, where he just went through and picked apart all of the media claims about, you know, how Trump was saying that neo-Nazis were very fine people. And geez, so, you know, he was on CNN and they asked Trump to condemn whatever the KKK and Trump wouldn't do it. And all this stuff where Scott just goes and shows how all these myths that have accumulated that quote prove, and geez, any right thinking person has just seen thousands of examples of what a racist, Nazi-loving monster Donald Trump is. And Scott just goes through and boo-boo and picks them all apart. And again, I'm pretty sure he hates Trump's guts. But the point is, he's just saying, this is insane. No, he didn't. And, you know, anyway, So that's the kind of guy he is. And the reason his posts are so great is because he doesn't just say something. He'll list like 15 examples of it with links so you know exactly what he's talking about. But anyway, he's definitely progressive. So anyway, that's who he is. So now we're coming back to this post here. Several years ago, an SSC reader made in a Reddit/SlateStarCodex subreddit for discussion of blog posts here and related topics. As per the usual process, the topics that generated the strongest emotions, Trump, gender, race, the communist menace, the fascist menace, etc., started taking over. The moderators, and I had been added as an honorary mod at the time, decreed that all discussion of these topics should be corralled into one thread so that nobody had to read them unless they really wanted to. This achieved its desired goal. Most of the subreddit went back to being about cognitive science and medicine and other less polarizing stuff. Okay, so this is me now again. Because what Scott does is a lot of his posts are like summarizing the latest literature on whatever, some new treatment, you know, some new pharmaceutical to treat depression or something. And so since, you know, he works at a psychiatric hospital, or he used to, he has to stay with that literature, right? So he's, a lot of his stuff is just going through clinical trials and the results published on these sorts of new drugs, blah, 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 you know, that kind of stuff. All right. Unexpectedly, the restriction to one thread kickstarted the culture war discussions rather than toning them down. The thread started getting thousands of comments per week, some from people who had never even heard of this blog and had just wandered in from elsewhere on Reddit. It became its own community with different norms and different members from the rest of the board. I expected this to go badly. It kind of did. No politics discussion area ever goes really well. There were some of the usual flame wars, point scoring, and fanatics. I will be honest and admit I rarely read the thread myself. But in between all that, there was some really impressive analysis, some good discussion, and even a few changed minds. And then he gives a bunch of testimonials from people who said they really liked the culture war thread. Okay. So, and then he goes through and gives statistics showing that, if anything, the average participant in this subreddit was on the left. And then Scott transitions into, so his blog posts are really long. That's why it's taking me, I'm scrolling through this thing. It's real interesting, but like I save his blog for when I'm flying. Like, cause it's, you know, when you're in airplane mode, like I load the thing up on my phone and then read it for an hour. So then he goes through and he's listing all of these major places like the New York Times and other major outlets that don't allow comments anymore, or at least on certain pieces. And he's saying at first that would be kind of funny because they all try to say, like, we're trying to promote the sharing of views and that's why we don't allow comments. And he's like, well, that's kind of Orwellian. But he's saying he gets what happened to them and why they don't do it anymore, even though they're doing like silly corporate speak. So now he's going to tell us the real story. All right. So what happened was, so let me tell you about my experience hosting the culture war thread. So again, just in case you guys are getting lost, this guy has his own blog. It's very popular. And he's mostly talking about like scientific studies and things. And if he is going to talk about something controversial, he's extremely careful and precise in what he says and lists 19 different things. And like I said, he's actually pretty much on the left on a lot of issues. Okay, so here it goes. But he was made the honorary moderator on this subreddit that originally was tied to his blog's presence on Reddit. And it was just funding all people in this thing called Culture War. Okay, so this is now back to Scott explaining what happened. People settled on a narrative. The Culture War thread was made up entirely of homophobic, transphobic, alt-right neo-Nazis. I freely admit there were people who were against homosexuality in the thread. According to my survey, 13%. People who opposed using trans people's preferred pronouns, according to my survey, 9%. People who identified as alt-right, 7%. And a single person who identified as a neo-Nazi, and then he's got parentheses, who, as far as I know, never posted about it. Less outrageous ideas were proportionally more popular. People who were mostly feminist but thought there were differences between male and female brains. People who supported the fight against racial discrimination but thought there could be genetic differences between races. All these people definitely existed, some of them in droves. All of them had the right to speak. Sometimes I sympathized with some of their points. If this had been the complaint, I would have admitted to it right away. So he's saying if the critics of this culture war thread said, hey, do you know they actually let alt-right people post stuff on that thread? And then Scott's saying, yeah, I would have said, yes, we do. Now, we don't let them use racial slurs or, you know, say anything mean to someone, you know, they're talking to. But if they want to post statistics about crime rates among different races or what, yeah, we let them do that. Okay, so that's where Scott's coming from. If the New York Times can't avoid attracting these people to its comment section, no way. And he's got, you know, r/SSC. So, you know, the Reddit thread devoted to his blog is going to manage it. But instead, it was always, meaning the narrative, the complaints from the critics about what they're doing at this subreddit thread. But instead, it was always that the thread was, quote, dominated by, or, quote, only had, or, quote, was an echo chamber for homophobic, transphobic, alt-right, neo-Nazis, which always grew into the claim that the subreddit was dominated by homophobic, et cetera, neo-Nazis, which always grew into the claim that the SSC community was dominated by homophobic, et cetera, neo-Nazis, which always grew into the claim that I personally was a homophobic, et cetera, neo-Nazi of them all. So now he's, you know, just, and he has a long sentence. He's ended with a period. Now he's telling us, telling the world, I am a pro-gay Jew who has dated trans people and votes pretty much straight Democrat. I lost a distant family in the Holocaust. You can imagine how much fun this was for me. Okay, so again, he's saying he's a Jewish doctor, he's pro-gay, and in his past, you know, his personal life, he has dated trans people and he always votes for Democrats, or pretty much. And he lost distant family in the Holocaust. So he's saying the idea that he actually is an alt-right neo-Nazi transphobic guy is ludicrous. But yet that's what these people were saying about him. Okay, so you're like, all right, so some people said some bad stuff. Jeez, Bob, why are you reading all this? Okay, hang on. Here we go. People would message me on Twitter to shame me for my Nazism. People who linked my blog on social media would get replies from people, quote, educating them that they were supporting Nazism or asking them to justify why they thought it was appropriate to share Nazi sites. I wrote a silly blog post about mathematics and corn eating. It reached the front page of a math subreddit and got a lot of upvotes. Somebody found it, asked if people knew that the blog post about corn was from a pro-alt-right neo-Nazi site that tolerated racists and sexists. There was a big argument in the comments about whether it should ever be acceptable to link to or read my website. Any further conversation about math and corn was abandoned. This kept happening to the point where I wouldn't even read Reddit discussions of my work anymore. The New York Times already has a reputation, but for some people, this was all they'd heard about me. Okay, so again, in case it's hard for you to follow what's going on, and maybe I wasn't using the proper voice intonation sometimes there. What Scott is saying is once this narrative started developing, and again, just make sure you get the point, he's got his own blog. On Reddit, somebody set up a thread, you know, for the community here of his blog readers. And then because there were some really controversial topics getting discussed, they set up a subreddit called Culture War and then had strict rules about, you know, you can't use racial slurs, you know, you can't threaten people. Blah, 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 blah. But, you know, any kind of policy you set up, his point was, well, I'll get to this in a minute. But, well, yeah, what happened was, because I don't want to spend too much time, he was explaining no matter what rule you set up, because, yeah, you feel uncomfortable someone posting something that you really didn't agree with. And it was awkward and, you know, but his point was you if the person was just merely saying, well, what Charles Murray wrote in page 80 of his book, The Bell Curve, was such and such. You know, you're going to say you can't quote from Charles Murray's book. Right. So that's the kind of position they were in. And then what if someone's an honest to goodness communist? You know, and they just want to quote something about the means of production and the, you know, the struggle of the proletariat or something. You know, are they going to say, well, no, because people died under communism, you can't post that view, even if you do it in a real civil manner. So his point was, as moderators, they could try to set rules and whatever, but ultimately people were going to post stuff advocating viewpoints that they strongly disagreed with, but they couldn't really exclude the person, especially since the whole point of this thing was to have civil discussions among people who radically disagree with each other. And so anyway, whatever you think about that, though, his point is just because he was actually was an honorary moderator of this thing, he didn't even spend much time on it himself. But since it was called SSC, you know, under the umbrella of that, and that's what his blog was, that now he, when he would go and write, even for some other website, a whimsical post comparing mathematics and corn eating, then the people there, instead of discussing the post, would say, hey, how come the moderators here are allowing this post here? What, are the editor of this website? Don't they know that the author of this hosts a blog that caters to neo-Nazis? And that it would develop into that. Geez, why are you promoting Nazism by posting? So his point was he would go everywhere, and that just started happening more and more to his online presence. That, you know, his enemies would find him somewhere. He'd get it where he was mentioned and go rush in to make sure that those people knew who they were dealing with. Okay, back to this guy's post. Some people started an article about me on a left-wing wiki that listed the most offensive things I have ever said and the most offensive things that have ever been said by anyone on the SSC subreddit and CW thread over its 3 years of activity, all presented in the most damning context possible. It started steadily rising in the Google search results for my name, a subreddit devoted to insulting and mocking me personally and culture war thread participants in general got started. It now has over 2,000 readers. People started threatening to use my bad reputation to discredit the communities I was in and the causes I cared about most. Some people found my real name and started posting it on Twitter, because again, he goes by Scott Alexander, but that's not his real name. Some people made entire accounts devoted to doxing me in Twitter discussions whenever an opportunity came up. A few people just messaged me, letting me know they knew my real name and reminding me that they could do this if they wanted to. Some people started messaging my real-life friends, telling them to stop being friends with me because I supported racists and sexists and Nazis. Somebody posted a monetary reward for information that could be used to discredit me. One person called the clinic where I worked, pretended to be a patient, and tried to get me fired. All right, well, I think that's enough. You get the point. So eventually he says he had a nervous breakdown. He said it wasn't too bad, that he just basically he kind of had to stay away from people for 2 weeks. And ultimately they shut down the thread, that he just, you know, cried uncle, said this, I can't do this anymore. And he had a neat thing at the end where he said, you know, he was listing the reasons why am I writing this blog post, like explaining what happened. And he's got a couple, you know, reasons like, hey, a lot of people liked that culture war thread, so I kind of wanted to tell them this is what happened, just to explain it once. He understands that, you know, if you give in to the terrorists, they're just going to increase their demands. Like, so he knows he's like exposing his neck now to these people, and they're going to even hit him even harder because now he's showing weakness. He gets all that, but he had a good point. He said something like, the problem whenever somebody prominent gets attacked like this and then complains about it, like, hey, you know, people are using unfair means to silence me, is that then their critics will say, whoa, you got a big platform, you're famous, so I guess the silencing isn't working, huh, Mr. Crybaby? And that's exactly what happened, you know, when there was the article about the dark web with, you know, Jordan Peterson and the names are escaping me right now, but there's other people who were, you know, saying, oh, we're the victims of all these, and then that was exactly what their critics said. Oh, Jordan Peterson, look at his Patreon account. He's world famous. He's got a bestseller, and he's complaining that, you know, he's not allowed to speak his mind because of the PC thought police. Give me a break. And so what Scott Alexander was saying is the people that really are just completely snuffed out and just cower and keep their head down because they got hit so hard by these people, you know, these totalitarian thought police characters, you never hear from them, right? By definition, right? If the censorship worked, and those people just, you know, realized they were outgunned and didn't want to fight and just ran for cover, you never hear about them. So the only people you hear about are the ones that stand up to them. And then, again, the critics can say, oh, well, you're still standing. So Scott Alexander thought, I'm going to do something that's never been done before. I'm going to admit these people won. They beat me. I'm surrendering and running away. But at least I'm going to say that publicly just to let everyone know how much they suck. And he literally does at the end. He says, and the last thing I'll say is F you to these, you know, the people who participated in this. So anyway, obviously I'll link to this at bobmurphyshow.com/21 if you want to read more. But reading that got me all fired up, and that's what pushed me over the edge, because another thing that just happened recently was our good friend Nick Sarwark, who is, technically speaking, I'm just looking here at his bio, he's the 19th and current chairman of the Libertarian National Committee, which is the executive body of the Libertarian Party in the United States. Okay, so Nick Sarwark, some of you may remember, he was the guy that when there was that against fascism pledge that a lot of libertarians were signing, and I didn't sign it because I don't sign pledges. Like that, in general, I think those things are goofy. And especially when people are like telling me I need to sign it to prove I'm not a fascist. Are you kidding me? That makes me all the, you know, heck no, I'm really not signing it. All right. And then Nick Sarwark posted a thing. Oh, it kind of speaks volumes that these guys aren't signing this. And it was me. I think that one, it was Tom, me, and Jeff Deist is, I think, the guys that Sarwark had in his crosshairs for that. And it raises questions, doesn't it? I wonder what it could possibly mean, the fact that they wouldn't sign this pledge. So anyway, the latest flare-up is that Tom was reacting to, there's a campaign now, in case you haven't noticed, been aware of it, to normalize sex work. Okay, so sex work is a blanket term now that encompasses, you know, prostitution, stripping, pornography, that kind of stuff. Okay, so phone sex operators, all that, those things, that's just broadly called sex work. Okay, and so there's a campaign among certain libertarians. Well, I mean, they could, people even just beyond that, but libertarians are involved, who that to say, like on Twitter or whatever, that sex work is work like any other kind of work, and we need to get people to realize that, and then that will both, you know, help make the push for legalization, which libertarians all agree with, and so that, you know, this is a way to achieve that. And also sort of just like shining a light on the cultural attitudes and trying to show, you know, the double standards involved. Okay, so that's where they're coming from. And by the way, I should say there's a lot of stuff that people who talk like that, let's say, who push that sort of line, they make a lot of points that I agree with. Okay, so again, with this stuff, the whole point of my episode here is, when you hear one little thing that you disagree, don't just automatically assume, oh, I know where this person's coming from, or, right? So I'm sure many of you assume you know 19 things that I must think about these left libertarians, and I'm guessing you're wrong on half of them. Okay. To give you my street cred, for example, somebody, it was like a right-wing conservative woman, had a post on Twitter recently saying something like, it's clear that if a man hires a prostitute and then wasn't going to pay her, she wouldn't sleep with him. She would walk away, right? So that shows she doesn't actually want to sleep with him. So if she does sleep with him when he pays her, that means it was against her will, and that's why prostitution is a form of rape. Okay, those weren't the exact words, but I'm not putting, you know, I'm not mischaracterizing. That was her argument. And so, you know, I retweeted that and said something snarky like, I'm pretty sure, or I was tempted to say something relating this to other types of work as an economist, but I think I'll just walk away from this one. Said something like that, you know, because it'd be such blow up and people getting histrionic on both sides. All right. So the point being that, yeah, that was a goofy argument that would not work with other types of employment, right? Like to say, gee, if I weren't getting paid, I wouldn't want to go work in a coal mine. And so therefore, the owners of coal mines are engaged in slave labor, right? Because labor is when you make someone, or slavery is when you make someone work against their will. And so the fact that you wouldn't work if you weren't getting paid means you don't want to do it. So it's not your will to go work in the coal mines. And so then even if they do hire you voluntarily, well, yeah, but it's still slavery. I mean, that's how goofy this lady's argument was, by which she was trying to prove that women were being raped who were prostitutes, like by its very nature. Okay, so anyway, so that's an example where, yes, that's a goofy argument, and what I did there was just applied it to other types of work to show how goofy that lady's argument was. Okay. But now what Tom was arguing, and for the purposes of this discussion, it doesn't even matter whether you agree with Tom or not. But what he was arguing is that he was saying, okay, this latest push, this trend I'm seeing among certain libertarians to, quote, normalize sex work, to say that sex work is, you know, there's nothing fundamentally different about it from any other kind of work, is wrong, and it will lead to bad consequences. And he said something like, here, I'll read his exact quote. If you treat sex as being just another activity, like eating pita pizza, example, sex work should be treated just like piano lessons. Don't be surprised when sex crimes aren't taken as seriously anymore. Okay, now I'm summarizing here. I'm crystallizing it down. Tom had a whole series of tweets where he was making this case. All right, again, saying, so Tom disagrees. He's saying, no, sex work is not the same thing as giving piano lessons or skiing lessons or cutting the lawn. It's not just merely a transaction. He had a thing like saying, I don't long to live in a world where a guy says, yeah, I went to the FedEx, mailed the package. Then I went and slept with a prostitute, paid her some money, of course. Then I went to the mall and picked up something for my kid. And then I went to see a movie and then I came home. It's not like those are just, that's a normal course of the day. And each of those, oh, yeah, I just went to a particular vendor and bought goods and services in exchange for money, the common medium of exchange. That he's saying, no, there is something qualitatively different about that, and that the drive to make it comparable to all those other ones, oh, it's just another form of work, Tom is arguing, is, for one thing, wrong, but also will lead to undesirable consequences, such as saying, okay, if there's nothing special about the intimacy involved there, well, then raping someone would be the same thing as, or no worse than, just compelling someone else to engage in a transaction against their will, right? That's what he was arguing, all right? So whether you like that or not, whether you think it's a good argument or not, that's what his point was. So he's saying, somebody who, if you heard that, oh, geez, do you know this guy didn't want to give ski lessons and somebody forced him to give him ski lessons, or, you know, some other labor that you could force someone to do, and how would you feel about that? And then that should be the same then as forcing someone to sleep with you, because you're just forcing them to do what their work is. And you've told us earlier that you should treat sex work the same way that, you know, there should be nothing, no other emotional baggage from, you know, Victorian England's moral system. This is just work. Gosh darn it. They're providing a service. You're giving them money. End of story. Don't slip in anything through the back door in terms of your hidden judgments, right? That's what the claim is. And so Tom's saying, okay, well, if we did that, then that would imply. It reminds me when I was younger, I was reading, there was a thing in my newspaper about a controversy regarding going to the beach topless. And, you know, so there was a push to allow women to do that. And so a woman wrote in favor of it. And then somebody, and she was saying stuff like, it's, you know, from the standpoint of equality, like men can go around topless at beaches. Everybody thinks that's fine. But do you think I want to see your big beer belly? You think I want to see your disgusting back hair? You know, fair enough. As someone who has back hair and arguably a larger than optimal belly, I get that. So, okay, fine. And so then somebody wrote a letter to the editor responding to that article saying something like, well, you know, if the goal here is to say that the female breast is the same thing as the male breast, okay. But then that means, like, if I go up to a woman and I bump into her breast with my arm, that's the same thing as if I did that to a man. And yet I don't think 99% of people are going to agree with me that's the same thing. I think they're going to be more insulted and think I did something worse if I bump into a woman's chest, especially if they think I kind of did it on purpose rather than if I did it to a guy. Okay. He said something like that. I don't remember his exact words. Actually, probably what he said is, if I went up to a woman and put my hand on her chest without getting her permission, and then I did the same thing to a guy, people are going to think the first thing I did was way worse. And he's saying, but how can that be if we're being lectured that there's no difference between the two and it's a quality baby? And so in response to that, of course, then some other lady wrote a letter that says, no, it's a violation of bodily integrity. You're not allowed to just go up and put your hand on other people's breast. You know, not getting his point that, yeah, you're not supposed to do it, but nobody freaks out if you go and do it to a man. And but you know, a lot of people would freak out if you did it to a woman, especially like the woman's husband or something would flip out. And the guy's point was he doesn't think that's just some arbitrary thing. He thinks there's something real there. And anyway, again, for the purpose that it doesn't even matter whether you think it's right or wrong, these arguments. I'm just explaining what they are. So anyway, back to Sarwark. So he quotes Tom, who was in the midst of arguing with somebody else, and says, my point is that if you treat sex as being just another activity, like eating pita pizza, example, sex work should be treated just like piano lessons. Don't be surprised when sex crimes aren't taken as seriously anymore. So Sarwark, like, you know, retweets, quotes that. And Sarwark says, do you have an example of reduced penalties for sex crimes in any of the jurisdictions that have legalized prostitution? The empirical data show exactly the opposite of your point, with reduced rates of sexual violence in those jurisdictions. Okay, so Sarwark is saying, in those jurisdictions that have legalized prostitution, the rate of sexual violence has gone down. And so he thinks that somehow refutes Tom. Now, unfortunately, Tom here fumbled the ball because he responded, Nick, I'm speaking about the very long run. And he goes on, which makes it sound like he's agreeing that Nick's point holds in the short run and Tom just means give it time. When, no, Tom totally missed that there. If he's going to be debating me on the Contra Cruise, Tom really needs a coach. And so I chime in and say, does it matter that Tom is for legalization and is speaking about normalization? I'm not saying there's data to support his claim or to refute it. I'm just saying Nick isn't even testing what Tom's claim is. Okay, because again, Tom is for legalization. And if you asked him why, he would say, well, first of all, the non-aggression principle. But also, I'm sure Tom is aware of, you know, the arguments about there's less violence that occurs when you legalize something that's happening in a black market, right? Just like you could be for legalizing the sale of cocaine, even if you were personally against people using cocaine, there's nothing contradictory about that. And one of the reasons, besides just, you know, the principle of it as a libertarian, one of the reasons is, well, because that will minimize violence, right? The drug war leads to gangland shootings and overdoses. Whereas you legalize the drug trade, there's no more violence among the sellers and there's fewer overdoses, right? Because it's pure name brand products and what have you. Tom knows all that stuff. And so I'm presumably he knows all that with prostitution as well. So again, my point is Sarwark saying, whoa, Tom, you're saying that normalization will lead to people not thinking rape is as big a deal as they currently do or that they do before the normalization happened. If that were true, then why do we see when you legalize prostitution that sexual violence goes down in those jurisdictions? And so I'm just pointing out there's no contradiction there at all. That's entirely consistent with what I know Tom's worldview is. Okay, so there's that. So then Nick Sarwark says to me, in response to me pointing that out, this is what he says. It probably would have helped if he had said so, meaning that he's for legalization of prostitution, instead of requiring people to assume. The two concepts are closely related. Normalization leads to legalization and vice versa. Okay, before I get into the gotcha here, let me just pause for a second. So here we've got the chair of the LP completely throwing under the bus decades of libertarian, that small L, education of the public. And now the critics could now call it propaganda, because I distinctly remember when I was young in libertarians with both capital L and small L would be making the case for drug legalization. The right-wing critics would say, are you kidding me? I don't want my kids smoking pot. I don't want it to be considered fine. And smoking pot is just as moral as drinking beer or smoking cigarettes. No, drugs are bad. And that's why they're illegal. And what is the standard textbook libertarian response to such an objection is to say legalization and morality are two distinct things. Just because something is immoral doesn't mean it needs to be illegal. Hey, it's legal to cheat on your spouse. That doesn't mean society is saying it's okay. Likewise, Mr. Rush Limbaugh type conservative, so the libertarian said when I was growing up, the fact that we libertarians want to legalize drugs in no way suggests that we're saying drug use is okay. If you want to teach your kids that heroin abuse and addiction is bad and dangerous, go ahead. Go, you know, show them movies, show them what happens. All we're saying is the state has no business penalizing conduct between voluntary conduct between consenting adults, throwing people in cages because one guy sold a plant to somebody else in exchange for money. That's crazy. And also look at all the violence that it spawns. All right, that was the standard libertarian response. They assured right-wingers that you could still believe that heroin use was wrong, but please agree with us that we should stop imprisoning people for selling or using drugs that were illegal at the time. All right. And so it's interesting that Nick Sarwark apparently is saying, yeah, that was all a Trojan horse. Libertarianism doesn't actually imply that at all. The reason drugs should be legalized is because there's nothing wrong with it. The reason we want to legalize prostitution and all this is because there's nothing wrong with it. And so for one thing, that's not libertarianism. But for another, if I were a right-wing Christian conservative like Dave Smith, that's an inside joke, folks, I would read this stuff from the chair of the LP. Again, people are saying, Bob, why are you giving him a platform? He's the freaking chair of the LP. All right, he has a platform, maybe not a big one, but we're not like dwelling on some six-year-old telling people that. I mean, that's what I would use to say, yep, you know, that if I were a right-wing Christian GOP candidate, I could just grab these things. Yeah. They're not hiding behind it anymore. They're out in the open saying they want to teach your kids that there's nothing wrong with, you know, heroin use and prostitution. And by the way, if you're listening to this and you think, yeah, what's the problem? Okay, my point here is not to pick a fight with you, but I am saying that libertarians for a long time have been trying to make the distinction and say, stop thinking that just because you think something's immoral, that means the state should throw those people in jail. That was a real big thing, and it's crazy to me that the chair of the LP is going to throw that principle, that distinction out the window in order to zing Tom Woods. Okay, but anyway, now back to the particular dispute here. So again, for those keeping track, Tom was making a point about what normalization would lead. So in this case, you don't know, normalization means trying to convince society, in terms of the cultural attitudes, that sex work is normal. Like, it's just like any other kind of work. Yeah, it's like, you know, office work, dental work, auto body work, sex work. You know, that's what it means. And so Tom was arguing, rightly or wrongly, doesn't even matter, that normalization of that would lead to a reduction in the social outrage at rape. Okay. So in response to that, Nick said, no, because I have empirical evidence showing that in places where prostitution was legalized, sexual violence went down. So again, I came in and said, Nick, what are you talking about? Tom is for legalization too. So he would agree with your claim there. That has nothing to do with what he was arguing. So to that, Nick says, it probably would have helped if he had said so instead of requiring people to assume. So then I responded to Nick and said, here, Nick, he said it literally in the comment prior to the one you retweeted from him. You must have seen it. Okay, and so I have a screenshot here. Obviously, folks, I'll put this BobMurphyShow.com/21 if you want to see the actual evidence. But I found that, you know, the thread that Nick had retweeted to get Tom saying, my point is that if you treat sex as being just another thing like eating pita pizza. By the way, Tom, why'd you say pita pizza? I'm like tripping. I'm surprised you didn't have an example of a prostitute called Sandy by the seashore selling, well, who knows what she was selling. It wasn't seashells, I'll tell you that. Okay, so in that thread, Tom is arguing with this other guy And so the guy says, so people in a free society aren't allowed to be free with their choices regarding sex and sex partners? And Tom said, I genuinely want to know if that is seriously what you think I am saying. Have you ever heard me say that voluntary contracts should be criminalized? Right. So at this point, Tom is baffled. He's flummoxed even. It's not just baffled. He's flummoxed. He can't believe someone thought his points about what normalization would lead to would mean, therefore, Tom actually must think that prostitution should be illegal or that sex workers, you know, should get hassled by the cops. Well, of course, Tom's not saying that. So Tom is, again, he's saying to the guy, I genuinely want to know if that is seriously what you think I'm saying. Like, he can't even believe that this guy thinks that. And then this guy goes, well, just looking for clarification, Tom. I'll be looking out for your email. All right. And then Tom says, my point is, and he reiterated what his point was. Okay. So that guy had been confused. Tom set him straight, you know, with amazement. Like, of course, that's, you know, I'm not for keeping it illegal. I'm talking about changing the cultural attitudes towards it to say it's no different from office work. And so, but so that was in the thread that Nick Sarwark had to have read to get to the one that he retweeted. It was literally two comments above, right? So it was Tom talking to this guy. The guy said something. Tom said that. The guy said, just looking for clarification, Tom, looking for your email. And then Tom comes in with a thing. Okay. So at this point, you know, this, if this were like an Encyclopedia Brown story and I was just, you know, the role of Encyclopedia there, the narrator would have said, you know, caught in his own lies, Bugs Meany's, you know, slinked away. But no, Nick Sarwark has less shame than Bugs Meany. He should have just walked away. I'm not saying he should have said, yeah, you got me. Geez, sorry, guys. Maybe Tom actually is a libertarian. Huh, cool figure. No, I'm not expecting him to say that. I would have expected him to walk away, but he doesn't. After I show that Tom, in the comment right before the one that Sarwark retweeted, said with amazement, you actually think I wanted to keep prostitution illegal? What's wrong with you? Sarwark goes, this in a quotation marks, have you ever heard me say not X, end quotation marks, is a very obtuse way of saying I am in favor of X. Okay, so he's still, Sarwark is still saying, no, I still, geez, it's understandable that I wasn't sure if Tom Woods was for legalizing prostitution because he said, have you ever heard me say that voluntary contracts should be criminalized is a really circuitous roundabout way. I mean, geez, why doesn't he just come out and tell people he's put. Okay. So anyway, my point here is Sarwark is not dumb. He knows full well that Tom is for legalization. He's playing some game here. Who knows? I've had various people contact me the last time this blowout happened to explain what the motivations were. I don't know. I'm not in the guy's head. All I know is he's not stupid. And this is the default position too, right? It's not like Tom has some weird nuanced version of libertarianism in which, you know, oh, it pops out at the end of this long chain of reasoning that it turns out he is for legalizing prostitution. This is standard stuff. Beyond that though, he's like, well, I don't know, here. From episode 1346, right? So this ran on February 20th of this year, right? So it's not like I have to go back eons before Tom discovered his true role as dog whistling to the alt-right and neo-Nazis and, you know, the people who think The Handmaid's Tale is an instruction manual or something, right? I mean, in case people are confused, I'm being sarcastic. These are the things I'm hearing people say about Tom on, you know, Facebook threads and whatever. So this is Tom from February 20th, 2019, talking with Professor Michael Rechtenwald. This is the guy who was the former Marxist, who was at NYU and all of a sudden had a change of heart and started an anonymous Twitter account calling out some of the crazy campus activism. And then, you know, the left unleashed all hell on him. So anyway, here's Tom talking to that guy. And you can hear him say that he's for legalizing prostitution. So you guys ready? Go ahead and play the clip.
I mean, I guess where I'm coming from is the, I did an episode on this not too long ago, is we look at old, like some libertarians and some conservatives, their concern is that there's been acidic eating away at traditional forms of association. So localities have no function anymore because all of those have been usurped.
Yeah. Or
whatever other types of things people might love and celebrate have, because you have a central state that can override anything. It can
That's
tell
true.
This institution what to
right.
do, that institution what to do. And, but yet it's all these institutions other than the state that make society work and that we're going to need.
Yes.
And especially the family.
That's right.
And then to just say, well, the family is just some stupid arbitrary grouping of individuals.
Right.
All right. Well, I mean, if you can try that theory out if you want, but
right.
I just, to me, that's just not what I'm about. It's not at all what I'm, or just, I just don't look. I don't want to criminalize prostitution either.
No.
I don't want to do that because, I mean, why should somebody's, you know, somebody has a bad moral foible. I don't believe in destroying the guy's life forever.
Right. Exactly.
For that. Okay. Now, I have no interest in remote temptation in that direction whatsoever, but that's irrelevant. I don't want aggression initiated against people. So, but
right.
at the same time, I don't get the positive celebration of this or the positive celebration of drug culture.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want people going to prison having their lives ruined because they use drugs. But at the same time, there's nothing whatsoever in libertarianism that requires you to positively celebrate these things.
Yeah, that's right.
Or call these people heroes or something. They're not. They're just people engaged in a transaction. You know, let's bring the rhetoric down a bit.
Right, there you go. So Tom is saying it. I hope in not too obtuse a fashion that he is for legalizing prostitution. And all he's talking about is not condoning it morally and thinking, oh, yeah, that's, you know, whether a woman becomes a heart surgeon or a prostitute, you know, same kind of thing, you know, it's great. By the way, again, I'm not sitting here saying, yeah, Tom, go get him. I'm just pointing out what he said and what he didn't say. All right. So chill out, everybody. I don't want to hear a barrage of emails condemning my own moral views on this. I'm just telling you what Tom said. Here's another one. Back in episode 1202 of the Tom Woods Show, he had on a lady, Emily Horowitz, professor at St. Francis College in Brooklyn, making the case to abolish the sex offender registry. Okay, so that's not something you would normally hear Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio championing. Hey, I'm going to get rid of the sex offender registry. Can you imagine? So it's not just that Tom isn't for the sex offender registry. He could have just kept his head down. He didn't need to take a position on this. But instead, he has someone on to talk about, to make the case for abolishing the sex offender registry. So again, just showing that Tom is very, you know, so, oh, what are you saying, Bob? Are you saying that Tom is for sex offense? Geez, I mean, maybe the reason Tom thinks that stuff about normalization is because he's actually... No, because he sees the problem with letting the state get involved in this stuff. That's why. So my point is, if Tom is so radical and is so willing to entertain complaints about insidious unintended consequences from even something like the prima facie to most normal people, well, yeah, geez, someone commits a sex offense. Heck yeah, I want them to be on a registry. I want the community to know about that so we can shun those people. And Tom is having a guest on to make the case for what? No, actually, that's a bad idea. All right. So again, whether you think that's a good idea or not, whether you like the discussion or not, the point is, it's not like Tom is some right-wing prude who just thinks, oh, I don't like stuff, and so I want to throw people in cages because they're not my people. That's obviously not his view. And also, I looked this one up. I mean, Tom reminded me of this, this episode, but I was scrolling through to see the comment. This is the first comment on the Tom Woods Show episode 1202. Just to show you, when I say he stuck his neck out, I'm not engaging in hyperbole. This is the first comment on that site or on that post. So in other words, the public has no right to know if there is a dangerous sexual predator within their midst, waiting for the next chance to predate, sexually assault a woman or a young woman or a young child to satisfy his sick, uncontrollable urges. To be sure, pedophiles should simply be executed. Rapists should be physically castrated. I suppose it's opposed to emotionally castrated. Anybody attempting to excuse this and cry foul because the convicted felons have been forced to register are the ones with the problems, especially the other two respondents to this episode. You are both sick, twisted people. Okay. Incidentally here, I don't know when he says you're both sick, twisted people. I don't know if he's referring to the other two commenters who liked the episode or if he's referring to Tom and the guest. But in any event, you can see the point there. Like, Tom knew full well, having this episode run, he was leaving himself open to these charges, but yet he thought it was very interesting. And this lady, you know, again, showing, look at the unintended consequences from something like this. Look at all the innocent people who get caught, you know, end up on these lists. I didn't listen to the episode, or if I did, it was a long time ago. But people ending, I've seen the problems with this stuff, right? That people end up on this list. You know, it's like some guy who's 18 and he's dating a 17-year-old and they're sending each other explicit photos. I think there are crazy cases where he gets charged with, you know, sex with a minor and then ends up on a sex offender registry for the rest of his life because of something like that, where, you know, normal people, when they hear that, they think, oh my gosh, is this guy a pedophile? You know, who's going to hire that guy? Who's going to want him to live in their neighborhood? When, you know, it was something like sending naughty photos to his 17-year-old girlfriend when he was 18. Some things like that are partly what's going on here, in case you've never heard someone say, yeah, this whole sex offender registry thing by the government is a terrible idea. Okay, but again, it doesn't matter. My point is, Tom is willing to have controversial things like that on his show, so he's not running and cowering. And even this one was in July of 2018. Okay, so it wasn't that long ago, this episode about abolish the sex offender registry. Folks, let's pause for a moment to talk about the Contra Cruise. That's right, the Contra Cruise, the libertarian event of the year. This year, 2019, the dates are July 5th through 12th. We're departing from Seattle, Washington. We're going to hit some Alaska ports, including a glacier. And we're also going to hit Victoria in British Columbia. I hear that this particular itinerary is just gorgeous. I've seen some of the pictures of it. The cruise liner itself is a good one. It's going to be great, but it's not just the cruise. It's the fact that it's the Contra Cruise, right? So we're going to have Brad and Deidre Berzer. You've probably heard them on Tom Woods' show. And Gene Epstein's going to be there as well. Not only is he going to give a talk and probably share all kinds of naughty anecdotes after hours with you guys, but he's also going to moderate the debate between me and Tom Woods. Now, if you haven't noticed, Tom's pretty competitive, and I'm no slouch myself. If you've seen on Twitter, it's cute. He's just so cute. He's trying to punch me, and he swings and misses. You give it to him. Really, it's going to be a great debate. You're not going to want to miss it. Also, there's music. We're going to have Dan Hagen back, Tatiana Moroz, my dad, Pat Murphy, the Pat Murphy, just to clarify, is going to be there. It's going to be phenomenal. In fact, in case you're still on the fence, you're like, you know what, but it's in your interest, Bob, to promote this thing. I want to hear some unbiased commentary from somebody I respect who's been on it before. Okay, here's an excerpt of Tom Woods talking to Naomi Brockwell. Many of you know who she is. She was a guest on last year's Contra Cruise. Tom had her on his show. The cruise naturally came up, and listen to what she had to say. We did not tell her to say this. She volunteered this. Play the clip, guys.
Naomi, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Total pleasure to have you on the Contra Cruise. We had such a great time, and your quiz show that you did with us was such an amazing hit. Even though I lost miserably, I've never enjoyed myself more losing miserably.
You lost valiantly.
That's right.
You lost with grace and style and pizzazz. No, it was super, super fun. I'm so pleased that I got to host it on the cruise, which was the best event I've ever been to in my life. I have to just go out there and say it was so much fun.
And there you have it. Do you want to skip this thing? Are you kidding me? Come on. Join us. The Contra Cruise. Go to ContraCruise.com for all the details. Hope to see you there. So enough about Tom. Let's talk about me. Here's another good example of what I'm talking about. So on my Wikipedia page, this is just hilarious. So for one thing, if you scroll my Wikipedia page, it turns out that the most important thing of my life was the fact that I made erroneous inflation predictions with Brian Kaplan and David R. Henderson. That gets more space than anything else that I've accomplished in my life, which is sort of impressive. But okay, So there's a section called Skepticism of Evolution, Defense of Biblical Literalism. And here, by the way, this stuff happens a lot where it truly just happened last week. Somebody on Twitter will be citing Paul Krugman favorably. One of my fans will chime in, perhaps with a bit too much bravado, perhaps a bit too much scorn. All right, not going to lie to you guys. And will say something like, oh, Krugman's an idiot. You got to read this guy, Bob Murphy. He's got a whole book demolishing this, you know, this simpleton or, you know, whatever. Words to that effect. And so then the person who was originally praising Krugman comes back with, and again, this really did happen just last week, but it's not the first time, and will say, huh, I checked out that guy's Wikipedia page. He's against evolution. Yeah, a real scientist laughing my ass off, you know, that kind of stuff. Sometimes they roll on the floor laughing, just to be clear. Okay, so let me discuss this. And by the way, for this, the Bob Murphy show, at some point, I got to get back up to speed on the literature and everything. I will do some episodes on intelligent design because the way the standard arguments go is totally ludicrous, right? So my point is not even going to be to convince you of anything except to show you the way this is normally argued with the standard representatives of Darwinian biology, quote, blowing up the ID people is goofy. And I'll show you that, I think, quite convincingly. But that's for another time. Right here, I just want to show you the misrepresentation of my position. So it says, in two LouRockwell.com articles entitled, Well, I'll Be a Monkey's Nephew and More Monkey Business, Murphy expressed skepticism about evolution, asserting that he, quote, can literally prove evolution is false, end quote, by pointing out that human beings act altruistically, which, in Murphy's view, cannot be explained by evolutionary motives. Okay, so I get... Someone who didn't know me and read that would think, what a moron this guy is. And then when it mentions that I'm a Christian and I believe in the Bible, would be, oh my gosh, I got this guy all figured out. I don't need to hear another word. This guy is an idiot. Well, what are you trying to tell me? These two monkeys had sex and then I came out. I don't think that's what happened. Oh, okay. I know this episode's already running long, so why don't we just very quickly, though, let me explain the context of that. So what happened is was I at Hillsdale? Yeah, I think I was at Hillsdale at this point. And I was reading as a professor. And so I somehow got back into this intelligent design thing. And I went and I checked out a bunch of books from the library, both like pro and con. In other words, like the standard biologists making the case, you know, for the standard view of the origin of life and all that stuff. And then I was reading the critics. And so this one guy I was reading was a book. It was called Science on Trial, The Case for Evolution. And it was by Douglas. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's Futuyma. It's Futuyma. So I'm probably butchering his name and I apologize if he hears this. So I was quoting one of his arguments to just show that he didn't really mean it, right? That this bravado of, oh no, it's falsifiable, that it's a game, that they don't actually mean it. And so here's what I did rhetorically. So this is, I'm quoting for myself now. So I was going through and making a lot of different arguments, you know, quoting him, rebutting him, da, da, da. And then I come in for the kill and I say, but all of the above analysis is superfluous. I can literally prove that evolution is false and on Futuyma's own grounds to boot. After wondering why a beneficent creator would condemn millions of species to extinction, Futuyma addresses the obvious creationist response this was all part of God's plan. To this, Futuyma answers, if this were true, we would expect to see harmony in nature, not struggle. Indeed, we would expect to see animals sacrificing themselves for the good of their species and even making sacrifices for the good of the natural community in which they live. If the theory of natural selection is true, though, organisms should have adaptations that serve purely for the survival and reproduction of the individuals who bear them, not for the good of any other individual or species. Darwin laid down the challenge in The Origin of the Species, quote, if it could be proved that any part of the structure of any one species had been formed for the exclusive good of another species, it would annihilate my theory, And then, end quote. So, but now it's Futuma still talking, right? So he was quoting from Darwin there. Now it comes back to Futuma. How has Darwin's challenge fared? No one has ever found a case of a species altruistically serving another without any gain for itself. Okay, so that's the quote. And then I come in and I say, again, I ask, oh, really? What about Homo sapiens? There are plenty of environmentalists who strap themselves to redwoods in order to save the trees from the exploitation of man. If you think this isn't a good example, because the people in question might be acting to preserve the long-run survival of the human race, what about the alleged scientists who are working to develop a virus that will only kill human beings in order to rid the Earth of our destructive presence? Isn't this a case of a species using one of its body parts, its brain, to altruistically further the interests of other species? And then I say, of course, Futuma would laugh at my examples. He would point out that human brains are certainly beneficial to their possessors and so can be explained by natural selection. But what of his claim put in bold above, where he said no one has ever found a case of a species altruistically serving another? Would Futuma back off that statement? I don't think so, because my examples wouldn't be the type of thing Futuma had in mind. What he really meant was that if we look at nature from the perspective of evolutionary biology, we don't see anything to contradict our assumptions. Any apparent counterexamples can be dismissed as irrelevant, even if those counterexamples, such as the capacity for human altruism, stare us in the face. Okay, so you see what I was doing there. I was just rhetorically calling that guy's bluff. He was trying to say, oh, we have a falsifiable theory. Darwin explained this, and so, hey, you show me a species altruistically serving another species without a gain for itself, and you guys win. Anybody? Anybody? Ha-ha. Sorry, guys. And so I pointed out, well, okay, there are human scientists working on virus. Well, they might not be official scientists, but there are people working to destroy humanity to save the planet. So there, right? Isn't that who he said doesn't exist? But again, and so I wasn't saying I just disproved evolution. I meant he threw down the gauntlet. Okay, so using his own challenge, there you go. I found an example. Oh, there goes Darwin's theory, right? That's what you said. So I was just calling his bluff. But the way, again, this Wikipedia article summarized that was to say, Murphy expressed skepticism about evolution, asserting that he, quote, can literally prove evolution is false, end quote, by pointing out that human beings act altruistically, which, in Murphy's view, cannot be explained by evolutionary motives. Okay, so do you see how unbelievably misleading that is? Someone reading that would think that I was saying, oh, geez, according to evolution, you know, if I help an old lady across the, you know, I shouldn't help an old lady across the street. If I did, it would only be to lull her into trusting me so I can punch her in the back of the head and then eat her. that's what they must think I mean there. Like, in other words, the altruistically part for me, you would think I meant altruistically towards other humans. If you were just reading this Wikipedia, you wouldn't know I meant altruistically serving other species. And you certainly wouldn't know that I was responding to a fan of evolution who is saying this is how you would prove it to be false. Because if you can find an example of altruism, well, clearly, you know, they're making it sound like I'm the idiot for not knowing how evolution handles altruism when, okay, well, I hope you guys get the point. How about another example? How about Jordan Peterson? So here he's talking to Camille Paglia and he's saying that women need to be the ones to regulate crazy women. Okay, so here's the clip. So, you know, it's a little bit provocative. I understand when people got a little uncomfortable, a little stirred up by it, but here's what he said. Okay, you guys ready? Yeah, play the clip.
You know, this is something my wife has pointed out too. She said, well, men are going to have to stand up for themselves, but here's the problem. I know how to stand up to a man who's unfairly trespassing against me. And the reason I know that is because the parameters for my resistance are quite well defined, which is we talk, we argue, we push, and then it becomes physical, right? Like if we move beyond the boundaries of civil discourse, we know what the next step is. Okay, that's forbidden in discourse with women. And so I don't think that men can control crazy women. I really don't believe it. I think that they have to throw their hands up in what? In, it's not even disbelief. It's that the cultural There's no step forward that you can take under those circumstances, because if the man is offensive enough and crazy enough, the reaction becomes physical right away, or at least the threat is there. And when men are talking to each other in any serious manner, that underlying threat of physicality is always there, especially if it's a real conversation, and keeps the thing civilized to some degree. You know, if you're talking to a man who wouldn't fight with you under any circumstances whatsoever, then you're talking to someone to whom you have absolutely no respect. But I can't see any way. For example, there's a woman in Toronto who's been organizing this movement, let's say, against me and some other people who are going to do a free speech event. And she managed to organize quite effectively. And she's quite offensive, you might say. She compared us to Nazis, for example, which, you know, publicly, yeah, using the swastika, which wasn't really something I was all that fond of. But I'm defenseless against that kind of female insanity, because the techniques that I would use against a man who was employing those tactics are forbidden to me. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Like, it seems to me that it isn't men that have to stand up and say enough of this, even though that is what they should do. It seems to me that it's sane women who have to stand up against their crazy sisters and say, look, enough of that, enough man-hating, enough pathology, enough bringing disgrace on us as a gender. But the problem there, and then I'll stop my little tirade, is that most of the women I know who are sane are busy doing sane things, right? They're off, they have their career, they have their family, they're quite occupied, and they don't seem to have the time or maybe even the interest to go after their crazy harpy sisters. And so I don't see any regulating force for that terrible femininity. And it seems to me to be invading the culture and undermining the masculine power of the culture in a way that's, I think, fatal.
Okay, so there you go. All right, whether you agree with that or not, you get what he's saying. Fine. I saw that treated by, I'm pretty sure, some libertarians too, but certainly his, you know, critics, and then people linking to it, you know, hit pieces on Jordan Peterson, you know, when they go and list all the horrible things he's done. And the way this one was described that you just heard was to say, you know, Jordan Peterson laments that he can't use violence to shut up women, something like that. Right. That, oh, there's summary, the way they're going to translate what he just said and paraphrase it for the outside world, like to save people time. Hey, you don't need to go listen to this interview or this discussion. Let me just tell you the news you can use. This is what you need to know about this guy, is he wishes it weren't socially unacceptable for him to use violence against women when they're bothering him. And now, oh, this stupid culture won't let me smack women around. That's what they're telling people Jordan Peterson's view is. Okay, so clearly the person describing it that way has to know that that's not true. Just like I didn't make the point, the person who wrote that Wikipedia piece on me has to know that that's not an accurate summary of what I was saying. Well, with a lot of this stuff, if you don't know the person, you know, they'd say never attribute to malice. I don't know. I don't know the person who did the piece on me in the Wikipedia entries. For all I know, that person honestly just is that dumb. But the person who wrote the hit piece on Jordan Peterson, I could tell from the rest of the article, was clever enough that he knew that that was a misrepresentation. Look, there's also, I was trying to brainstorm to say, are there cases where my side does this stuff too? Because I realize this just sounds like, hey, all these people are picking on us. And I'm sure other people would get upset. Incidentally, though, what came to mind was the MMTers, if you guys are following that stuff, where like Stephanie Kelton just keeps complaining. Say, everyone's accusing us of saying deficits never matter. But we, you know, I say it all the time. They do matter. And then I'll go. But the thing there is, I think they're actually doing what I'm complaining about here. That I'll go and find a quote from Bill Mitchell that clearly says deficits don't matter. He says a thing. He had a deficit finance post and said, a lot of people email me and ask, why don't we need to worry about deficits? And here's why. Well, because they add to private net saving. Not a word about hyperinflation under certain conditions. So, you know, there, when the guy says people email me to say, why don't we need to worry about deficits? And then he says, oh, because government deficits are the source of private savings. And so if the government were to run a surplus, that would actually reduce private savings. And so don't you want to have private savings, which are the source of wealth and wage growth? And da, da, da. a normal person could quite understandably say, oh, so MMTers are saying deficits don't matter. Right. So it's the other way. And then people bite my head off for putting that up there. So actually, even though on the surface it might look like the MMTers are the ones being, you know, oh, geez, we're being quoted out of kind of, I don't think they are. But in any event, I did consider that stuff. That's, I guess, the closest thing I can think of. But even here, it's not that bad, or it's not as bad. These memes floating around with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or AOC. I'm going to do a whole separate episode on that. But I think that stuff, yeah, some of it's kind of funny. But in general, I think that's unfair, number one. But also, two, it's just, it's strategically unwise. If your goal is to limit her influence, having this campaign to make fun of her, I think, is going to blow up in your guys' face. So in case you don't, be the ones that like show her with her big eyes and she's standing outside of, you know, it's photoshopped with her next to like a Subway, like, you know, the restaurant Subway. And said, geez, I've been standing outside the Subway for an hour. Where's the train? You know, that kind of stuff. And just, you know, taking photos of her that make her look goofy and then putting fake quotations on it. Just, you know, that's the kind of thing. But even there, it's not the same because everybody knows that's a joke, right? It's a mean joke, you could say. It's an unfair below the belt, but people aren't actually believing that those are real quotes. The thing, I guess, the closest would be that hoax that went around with, you know, the Green New Deal, and they did a good job of making it look like it was the same format from that Google Doc version of the actual thing that the staffers put up there, saying that part of the Green New Deal would get Americans to drink their own urine and like, oh, well, you store it in refrigerators to get rid of the urine smell or whatever, or to get rid of the pee smell. But it was so patently absurd and ludicrous. It was clear it was a hoax. By the way, if you fell for that, if you thought that was actually in the Green New Deal, you don't have a good model of AOC and her staff. Okay, I instantly knew that that wasn't real. Whereas the stuff about getting rid of air travel, I was like, yeah, that could be real. All right, so I'm just saying, if you thought that they had in their document that we're going to make Americans drink their own urine, I think your view of them is off. Okay. But again, even there, that is an obvious hoax. So I'm not complaining here. Like, if somebody just started a hoax about something Tom Woods said or something I said, you know, if it were clever, I might think it was funny. But, you know, that's a separate thing here. These are not hoaxes. Right. These are people with a straight face trying to, quote, inform their listeners about the horrible things Tom Woods believes or Jordan Peterson or the stupid anti-scientific views of this idiot Bob Murphy, who thinks he blew up evolution because he doesn't understand altruism. You idiot. OK, you get the idea. How about this one? I guess the closest thing I could come up with, and again, it's not that big a deal, but I'm trying here to be objective, is if you have ever said, oh, Paul Krugman hopes we get invaded by aliens and that'll fix the economy, that's not quite right. All right. Technically, what Krugman said was it would be good in the midst of a depressed economy where the central banks run out of ammunition and you've got people afraid to run budget deficits of adequate size and power. If the public erroneously believed an alien invasion was imminent, and then allowed the leaders to build a bunch of weapons, which then it turned out we didn't need. All right. So technically, he wasn't hoping for an alien invasion. He was hoping for a false alarm concerning an alien invasion. All right. So again, there, I think many people would say, well, okay, yeah, but still, what he was saying was pretty stupid. All right. So, but again, there's the path to the dark side. That's kind of what I'm saying here, that I'm sure a lot of the people, when you pointed out, would say, oh, okay, yeah, sure. Jordan Peterson didn't literally say, I wish I could smack these crazy women around. But come on, what he did say was pretty awful. What a sexist, misogynist. And so I'm saying, if the way you're excusing it when you do it to your enemies is, well, okay, yeah, they didn't say that, but still they suck. And I just need to let everyone know how much they suck. Well, that's what your enemies are doing to you. That's how they're justifying lying about what you say. So, you know, take one or the other, but you shouldn't be inconsistent about it. I did have a private guy that happened with that whole ludicrous nightmare affair about the Covington kids when that thing dropped. And there was a guy on Twitter that I knew who was saying something about somebody else, like who had commented on it. and what the guy I knew said was not correct. Like, he misrepresented. And I said to the guy, you know, I don't know if I said it privately. We eventually took it private. I don't know if I said something originally, but certainly privately, I said, hey, you know, the guy actually posted this. I think the way you did. And he was like, hey, this, you know, I'm done being charitable. This is war. These people are trying to destroy civilization as we know it. And I understand where that mentality, where you're like, are you kidding me, Bob? You want to be careful and make sure we parse all these people's statements right when they're trying to, you know, get 17-year-olds' lives ruined because they stood there quietly wearing a MAGA hat while, you know, I get all that. I understand. But I'm just saying, when you start justifying tactics that when the other people do them to you, you would cry foul and say, well, it's because we're at war, or, well, they're doing it to us. That's, you're never going to come back from that, because then the people on their side are going to see you doing it and say, well, they're doing it to us. And that's why that's how they sleep at night, lying about what Jordan Peterson or Tom Woods say, because they think, well, look at how much these other, you know, these right wingers lie about what we stand for. Let's take a break, folks, from my rant to talk about the Laura Murphy Report. In the latest issue, February 2019, I go over my recent presentations where I explain where the U.S. is vis-a-vis Austrian business cycle theory. Bottom line is, if the Fed continues to tighten, and I think it will, I think the yield curve is eventually going to invert this year, and that you're going to see a recession either in late 2019 or in 2020. Again, that's if present trends continue, which I think they will. To see that analysis, you want to subscribe to the Laura Murphy Report. For more information, go to bobmurphyshow.com/LMR. Okay, so what's the conclusions from this? So obviously, I just spent most of this time singling out some of these examples, that kind of thing. I mean, but you see this all the time, right? So again, I'm being very particular here. I'm not just complaining about, oh, the climate on social media and doxing and what I'm saying is, if the way you're vilifying people is by lying about what they actually said, or by saying something that, yeah, technically it's true, but you know full well the recipient of your message is going to infer something that's far worse than what the person actually said, then that's wrong. You should stop doing that. And it also leads to bad things besides just the fact that you're not supposed to do bad stuff like that. So obviously, one downfall of that, or one of the negative consequences, is the harm to the targets, right? So like this guy, Scott Alexander, you know, has a nervous breakdown. They have to shut down that thread. I think they tried to migrate it somewhere else that it wasn't connected to him. But I mean, that caused him a lot of personal angst. I skipped over some of it, but the problem he was facing was, you know, he's into a lot of projects, like pet causes, like effective altruism. And effective altruism? Uh-oh, I hope he doesn't disprove the case for evolution accidentally. Maybe it was a good thing that he shut the... Anyway, so he's involved with all of these different projects. And then he realized it was a concern that, well, gee, if he is associated with something and then all these other people come in just to go nuts and bring up neo-Nazi sympathizer and all that stuff, it ruins everything. So he like can't do anything. All right. So there's that element involved, like the unfairness to the recipients. By the way, I forgot to mention at the time, but part of my learning process here is at one point I saw someone write a hit piece about Tom. This was several years ago. And I went through and I read it, and it was like there was no demonstrably false sentence in the whole piece, but the whole thing was so incredibly unfair and misleading. If you didn't know who Tom was and you read this thing, you would think he was a monster. And so when I read that, I was like, whoa, because it hit me. How many hit pieces like that have I read about people I didn't know personally and just assume that, oh, yeah, that guy sucks, right? So just keep that in mind. And I really can't stress, it's like the reason I was telling my son it was icy and he hadn't yet fallen. He finally did fall, and I think it taught him respect for the ice. And I was saying, until you slip and fall on the ice, you don't realize how dangerous it is. And so he did slip. I guess I mentioned he actually did slip and fortunately didn't hurt himself, just kind of cut his hand a little bit or something. And I thought that was a good thing. Like, okay, now you get it, right? Okay. So likewise, I'm saying until you have actually experienced it, until you've seen a, a well-written hit piece attacking somebody you know personally, you really can't imagine just how shameless some of these people are. It's astonishing. Just the willful misrepresentation of somebody's views to make them look like a monster. So the point is, because there are people that do that, I implore you, do not just assume. And also, too, I've even seen in my personal life where some people will sit there and tell you a bunch of stuff about people you don't know. And you're like, oh, my God, geez. And then at some point, if they say something about someone you do know, or like if you hear how they recount an incident where you were there and you saw what happened, and then you're like, wait a second. And, you know, there's that kind of element involved, too. And with some of this stuff, it's not even like you're saying the person's a liar. Like maybe they just interpreted it differently or whatever. But there was a great game when I was growing up. Oh, it was amazing. And actually, maybe some of you, if anyone knows this game, put it in the comments or email me, because I want to get this game and play it again and show it to my son. It was awesome. But this computer game where you start out and you're like on a colony somewhere, like Earth sent out ships and they put a colony on some planet. And the two different, like there's two little bases or something, like two sides, like the humans on one side of the moon or something, whatever this thing was. You know, they have their little installation, you know, their space station that's on the moon or the planet, whatever it was. And then the other guys on the other side, and they're at war with each other. And so you start out the game and you're on in one side and you go look at a briefing video that says why we fight. And it lists all the bad things that the other side did to your side. You know, like, oh, 6 months ago, they attacked this installation here. And then they did this. And so this is why what we're going to do is do the strike and da-da-da-da, right? And so then you go in and you're it's a cool computer game and you're controlling tanks and whatever. And you go hit them because, you know, these jerks. And then so when you win that element of it, when you solve that, then it, you know, the next level or whatever, it reboots and you're on the other team. And then when you go and look at their briefing, the stuff that you did is your campaign, like, you know, when you from the first person or the, you know, the original perspective is what the other side uses in their briefing video to show what monsters those people on the other side of the moon are. So it was awesome, like just to show that, yeah, nobody likes getting attacked unfairly. And so when, yeah, the other side, you know, hits your daycare center or something, whoa, that's terrible. So then you hit them back. And then, but of course, the people on the other side aren't like, well, we kind of deserve that because we did hit their daycare center. No, they're like, oh, I cannot believe they just hit our senior center. Do you know how many old people they just killed? Well, let's launch our ICBM. So anyway, it was a really cool game just to show, because it was a really good game, you know, period, in terms of the gameplay or whatever. But then that had that little twist to it when you realized, oh, the thing that this briefing is showing is what I myself did, you know, 10 minutes ago when I was controlling the tanks. I was the one who hit the daycare center or whatever. I don't remember. It wasn't a daycare center, but it was, you get the idea. Anyway, if anyone knows what game I'm talking about, contact me because that was awesome. All right. So back to the fallout from this. The other thing that this does is it chills speech. And I mean, everybody kind of knows this. Like, oh, gee, yeah, but I don't think people fully appreciate. Because if you, like all this stuff with, young kids getting hormone treatment and stuff to transition, whether you think that's a good idea or not, I guarantee you 90%+ of American adults do not think that's a good idea. And they think, whoa, that's, yeah. But they keep their mouth shut. Why? Because they don't want to get fired, or they don't want to have just a huge harassment campaign. They don't want to be trotted into, you know, human resources and have to talk to the HR person about, yeah, we saw this post of yours on Twitter where you said you didn't think 6-year-olds should be getting transitioned. And we got a call from so-and-so down in accounting and no one wants to deal with that. So they keep their head down, they keep their mouth shut. And so what ends up happening is extremists are the only ones who dominate the conversation. So if your group happens to be the ones who are loudest right now to have the loudest bullhorns, you might have no problem with that. Like, yeah, the average American, they do have these outdated notions, leave it to beaver mentality, and they should keep their mouth down because, you know, we're sick of being oppressed and we're going to stand. It's going to consume you. This is going to blow up in your face. You're not going to be able to contain this. This is like the opening stages of the French Revolution, and it's going to turn into the terror. This is not good. You will not be able to contain this. You will not be able to put the genie back in the bottle. Whatever metaphor, cliche you want to use, this is not going to go well. It's going to get to a point where even you, if you could see it 20 years from what now and what this is going to develop into, would agree, yeah, we shouldn't have gone down this path. Another element, and by the way, that's what's so ironic about this stuff, is that Scott Alexander is not some right winger. You know, this isn't like Alex Jones getting deplatformed, even though I disagree with that too. But this is a guy, again, I read to you some of his personal biography. This is not someone who's normally supposed to be in the crosshairs of this kind of campaign. But what's ironic is that Scott Alexander himself in the past has been pretty smug about dismissing certain people. Like, so I remember when he reviewed Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life, it was amazing. Scott would sit there and say how when he was reading the book, he became a better person that week. Like, Jordan Peterson's book was making him become a better person. And he was saying this unironically, but then he couldn't help himself. Scott Alexander in the review would keep coming back to like just random digs about lobsters and stuff. Like, in other words, he kind of had to say to his readers, look at, I know this guy Jordan Peterson is a buffoon and just, you know, just, oh my gosh, his social views. And can you believe this guy? Oh my goodness. But you know what? Guys, hear me out here. There were actually some good things in his book. Now, I know the lobster guy. That's kind of the tone of his review, which was like, are you kidding me that someone wrote a best-selling book that makes you want to be a better person and your go-to move is to mock him just to win street cred with your readers? So that was weird. Also, he just had throwaway lines about, you know, Pat Buchanan and, you know, Nazi sympathizer and stuff like that. It was just, or no, maybe it was like Holocaust, but it was some really strong term that, you know, I knew what he was referring to at the time. And it was like, no, that's not what Buchanan's view was. I mean, you can say you don't like Pat Buchanan, but it was a throwaway smear. In fairness, I don't think Scott Alexander knew what Pat Buchanan had written that got him those smears attached to him. I think he was just mindlessly repeating them. But anyway, just another example. And then he even had a more recent post. It was a very interesting statement, you know, argument, where he was talking about geniuses who, you know, he was saying, like, what if there was a black box that 50% of the time would shoot out some really brilliant idea comparable to Einstein's relativity, but 50% of the time would shoot out a false idea? Wouldn't that still be the most valuable box on planet Earth? And of course it would, because you could just go, you know, test them and see if it's false. You rule it. And then he said, well, what if, you know, 99% of the time it set out a false theory, but 1% of the time it set out, you know, something like the next relativity. It'd still be great, right? Okay. And so then he just goes through and says, well, that's what like geniuses are, right? That they, if you go and look at actual geniuses that we revere, they held some pretty nutty views. In addition, like Isaac Newton was all into Bible codes. Oh, what the heck? And he just lists a bunch of people who have weird views. And he gives examples of like, oh, people who don't think HIV causes AIDS, or people who believe in, you know, 9/11 truthers. And he just, and so it, my point is just that Scott Alexander has his own list of people who are just, we don't need to take them seriously. Those are, you know, nut job fringe people. And so it's ironic that, you know, he's falling victim to this as well. You know, this kind of mentality. So anyway, the lesson here is, again, if you demonize people because you're so sure you're in the right and they're wrong, don't be surprised if this thing turns back and blows up in your face. To clarify, I'm not saying, oh, Scott's getting a taste of his own medicine. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying something much weaker than that. I'm just saying, though, it is ironic that I've noticed the one thing I don't like about Scott Alexander is his frequent sort of dismissive remarks about whole groups of people based on their crazy beliefs. When it's like, no, I mean, yeah, it's a lot of those people that don't necessarily agree with them, but their beliefs aren't any crazier than the stuff that gets trotted out on Fox News or on MSNBC concerning U.S. foreign policy. And yet those people are respectable. They're not on the fringe. They're not considered nut jobs. And the other thing, too, on this, in terms of just the loudmouth speak, because everybody else keeps their mouth shut, is that it – when the outrage mobs demonize people for what everybody knows is completely innocuous language, then to give an example of what I mean, I think one of the most insightful comments that Michael Malice made in his frequent appearances on the Tom Woods show is they were talking about, there was something in the news at the time where somebody, you know, some commentator or whatever slipped up and he referred to a black person as a colored person, right, on the air or something. I don't know if the guy got fired or he just had to apologize, but that was the deal. Like that was, oh, you called him a colored person? You know how racist that is? You know how patronizing? And right, that was the deal. And so Tom was saying, it's kind of weird because right now, you know, the term, the acceptable term evolves over time, right? Like it was Afro-American, African-American, and now it's person of color, and people abbreviate it POC. And so Tom was saying, it's interesting that calling them person of color right now shows, you know, how woke you are and you're up to speed with sensitivity and whatever, and you're checking your white privilege at the door. But if you call them colored person, it's like one step better than the N-word. And he was saying, it's interesting, like a preposition really is that powerful and that potent to diffuse, you know, the racism involved in the language. It's interesting. And Michael's Malice's point was to say, yeah, this is all by design, right? That the people in charge of this narrative, like they have the power, right? They want it. They intentionally keep changing the label to keep everybody else back on their heels. Hey, I'm not racist. Whoa. You know, I slavery was awful. I'm sorry. Jeez. That's to keep everyone disoriented. Like imagine like an interrogator at Abu Ghraib or something, like lights in your face and yelling bark. That's the effect they want it to have. So yes, it's supposed to be, or just like the, you know, LBG and how they keep adding letters to it. It's supposed to get to the point where you cower and cry uncle and just say, yeah, I can't keep up with this. And I don't know. Jesus, you know, maybe young kids should get trans. I don't know. That's deliberate, he's saying. Okay, now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I thought that was a very interesting perspective he had to say this isn't just some spontaneous thing with the label keep changing, that's intentional. So anyway, what ends up happening is when the outraged mobs claim their victims and they get their pound of flesh from people that everybody knows didn't mean. There was a thing in upstate New York, Rochester, where I grew up, where there was some guy, a weather reporter, weatherman. Yeah, he wasn't the, he was like the actual meteorologist, I think. And he, you know, he comes out and they trot him on the TV thing, and he was saying something about, I don't know if it was, he was referring to Martin Luther King, and he kind of stumbled, and I think it sounded like he said a slur or something. It was really hard to hear. You couldn't even get the YouTubes of it. That's the thing. I think I heard like somebody had it on their TV or something, but I never really even heard what he said. And, you know, then he gets fired and he's, you know, crying with his wife and whatever and trying to get his job. And the point is, of course, what kind of, he didn't get up there. It wasn't like he had a hot mic on and was joking around the, you know, the water cooler with his white buddies. And then they said, okay, you know, you're up in five. And then, you know, he said something like total race. That wasn't it. He was on the air and he just stumbled over his words and mixed the syllables up. And it sounded like, if you listen really carefully, wait, did he just say? And the point was, and he just kept going, you know, and so then the outrage was, well, once he said that out loud, he should have apologized. And again, I wish I could give you better details, but it was like, I couldn't even get, because by the time the story became big and I went to review it to see, well, what did he say? You couldn't get any evidence of it. It was just everyone, just the news accounts all reported that he said this, you know, horrible thing on the air, and it was hard to even get evidence of. But anyway, something like that, I think everybody knows. He didn't go up and just say, hey, I'm going to say this word. That's goofy. Everyone knows that. Or again, like the other person who got in trouble that flubbed as a colored person, you know. Anyway, they know that these people don't mean to do what they're being accused of. They still get destroyed. And so the problem with that is, again, besides the fact that it's, oh, gee, the punishment exceeding the crime, the problem then is there are actual racists, right? And then, like, I've seen people write crazy, disgusting, horrible white supremacist stuff on social media. And then if somebody objects to it, they'll say, now you're going to get all PC thought police on me? Jeez, what are you, an SJW? Right, because they're, like, talking to other libertarians. They're like, dude, what are you doing? Take your, you know, eugenics and take a hike. And then that will be the response, right? And so you can see how it's difficult. You know, you say, well, no, actually, in this case, the thought police is crazy. That's the point, right? Like the boy who cried wolf, whatever metaphor you want to use, or going back to the traditional libertarian arguments for drug legalization, that if this was a standard argument that was used to say, hey, you know, if the police are out there punishing victimless crimes and locking people up for stuff, you know, your kids are told, oh, marijuana is so bad for you and everything. And then you learn that, wait a minute, you know, the adults were exaggerating all the bad things in your life, that would breed disrespect for the law, right? Breed contempt for the law if the law is punishing things that should not be criminal, right? That was a standard thing. So likewise here, if people are being fired for stuff that everybody knows privately, yeah, that guy, he wasn't trying to say something right. You know, yeah, maybe the words came with the right, but that he didn't mean anything about it. If that's what happens, then it becomes harder to isolate and actually use social stigma and pressure to punish, if you will, or contain or minimize, whatever verb you want to use, the actual racists who I admit they do exist. So it's gotten to the point, and I'll wrap up with this, where the only people left who can actually tell the truth on this stuff are comedians, like professional comedians, because you have to, if you're going to say something truthful, you have to first get everybody on your side by making them laugh for 20 minutes. And only then can you very deftly move into the area you want to explore and say the truthful thing. And even then, you better make them laugh, right? It's like that quote, if you're going to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh or else they'll kill you. And I've seen that attributed to John Lennon, and I just looked it up. It's attributed to George Bernard Shaw and all these people. So I don't know who actually said that thing, but it's a good quote. You attribute it to Bob Murphy. So on that note, and the other reason too is, of course, because professional comedians, especially nowadays, you know, if they have their own platforms, that they can't get fired, right? It's just, you know, they get an audience that likes them. But again, even among the broader community, they can get away with saying stuff that regular people can't if they just said it without jokes, without warming people up first. Serving the function of a court jester, right? Like historically, the court jester is speaking truth to power, right? The court jester can mock the king to his face and get away with it, whereas somebody else did that, he'd be executed or thrown in the dungeon or something. So on that note, why don't we end with a little excerpt from lately, Dave Smith and Robbie the Fire. Robbie the Fire, just knocking it out of the park. And it's, I thought, oh, they must just have gotten objectively better. Because in the beginning, you know, I liked Dave and thought it was good. And they talked about stuff. But I just, you know, it wasn't like I went out of my way to go listen. And now it's like if some issue is in the news that I want to hear commentary on, I go to hear Dave and Robbie talk about it. And you say, oh, because you like their impressions of Bernie Sanders or Trump. Yeah, yes, I do. Don't get me wrong. But it's because they can speak the truth. That's the most truthful commentary I know of right now, where they, when it gets to sensitive things, they say stuff that everybody knows is correct, but they don't want to say it because they don't want to, you know, offend people or get fired or whatever. Whereas it's also because they're Jewish, so they can get away with saying more than I could get away with, if you get how that logic works. But it's also because they're funnier than I am. And so anyway, why don't we end with, just to give you an example of what I mean, just my little play. Dave didn't tell me to do this, by the way. This is totally coming from me. This is Dave and Robbie talking about when that scandal of the Covington kids and the, you know, Phillips and all that stuff. Just listen to this little excerpt. That's what we'll end on. And of course, in the show notes page, I'll put links to this if you want to go hear their whole episode. By the way, we're going to protect you here in your tender ears here on the Bob Murphy Show. But if you go to listen to the actual episode, there are some naughty words, just so you know.
Anyway, let's get back to the video.
I definitely felt threatened.
There were more of you than them, but you felt like they were
looking at me a little bit.
A group of adults, and I wasn't sure what was going to happen next.
Yeah, it's just pause unclear. It for a second.
I'm not offending this kid. This kid is great. He seems like a nice kid. I'm pointing out the fucking lunacy of that. This is a threat.
I agree with
it
you
must
completely.
Be his whiteness. But I just see
like,
white. And,
oh,
yeah.
you were afraid of these few black Israelites, but there was more of you than there was of them. Like, lady, let me assure you, if it came to a physical altercation, those three black Israelites would beat the shit out of those 30 Christian kids. They would try to fight back with their school sports chants. Okay. They were not a threat to anybody.
And there you have it. So in conclusion, listen to Dave Smith. He's got good stuff over there. And if you want to criticize someone, if you want to let people know how bad somebody is, that's fine. All I'm asking is don't lie about what the person did. And if you really want to push yourself, if you really want to strive for excellence and fair play, don't even say something that's technically true about your enemy, but is wildly misleading, because that's a low blow. It doesn't help any. It discredits you. And then again, it actually bolsters the people who really are the bad actors, because then people stop believing you or your side when they call out stuff, because they've no longer trust you. It's like with the whole fake news stuff, that at this point CNN could have tape of Donald Trump murdering a migrant on the Mexican border, and his supporters would say, no, I don't believe that, because of all the other stuff CNN has done up to this point. Oh, that was a happy way to end the episode, wasn't it? Thanks for listening, everybody. Catch you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of the Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.